Hello and welcome to The Realm. I'm Dr. K and I bring the psychology.
I'm Dr. D. I bring the strategy. We are business psychologists and your guides to the executive realm, where we bring psychology and strategy together.
So that you can bring your best to C-suite, your teams, and your customers. Today, we're going to be talking about life after COVID. This is part two of our post-COVID workplace series, where we will explore the psychological risks teams will face, the support people may need, and how to approach the complex mental health needs to keep your team safe and your work environment healthy. Let's do it. Let's get to work. Hello, Dr. D. How are you doing?
I'm good, Dr. K. All right. So we're talking about the psychology of the post-COVID workplace. That's right up your alley.
It has been amazing. So many changes have come from this. You know, how some people have, you know, taken this being, you know, working from home and being in quarantine, and they've taken it and run with it and have done so many amazing things. And then on the opposite end, it's really hurt people. You know, you've been, you know, working from home. How have you been? You are a traveler.
Well, not anymore. Just at home all the time. For everybody, it's good and bad. I imagine I've been able to spend a lot more time with family, which is nice. All the opportunities to watch my little guy get bigger and help him with school a lot more, which is a blessing and a curse with kids being home from school an awful lot. But missing the social environment of going out and chatting with people and not being nervous about sitting on an airplane or being able to shake hands with somebody, pat them on the back without worried about what you might bring home to your family.
Right. Do you miss, because you used to travel a lot more, do you miss it at all?
Naturally, I'm an introvert, though I play an extrovert on TV. Not really. In some ways, yeah, I miss the freedom that comes along with traveling. The ability to look a client eye to eye and pick up on all the subtle emotional cues after a meeting, those little side conversations that happen, where you pick up a lot of informal information about opportunities and how people might really be feeling. Those little aside conversations are really, really valuable. And it's really tough to have those impromptu, off the cuff, really get the idea behind what's going on when at the end of the call, it's a Zoom. You know, you hang up or your WebEx is over. You don't have the opportunity to walk out and walk with the person to their next meeting or that sort of thing. So you miss out on a lot, frankly. And for a person who tries to build relationships by having informal conversations, it's really tough for me to build that rapport with people when all you really have is formal meeting time. You can call somebody, but it's still a formal meeting. You have to be prepared, and you're not really getting the true thought behind what's going on.
Right. Right. I mean, it's, you know, for me working with clients, it's been so helpful working from home because I can reach out to more people. And we, you know, being that I was in LA at one point, you know, people would be so frustrated by the time they got to my sessions because of traffic or trying to find parking. And it would be, even if they lived in the area, it could be, you know, almost a 2-hour ordeal. You know, getting there, parking, you know, walking up, all that stuff. Sometimes they couldn't park very close. Then the session itself, and then, you know, having to drive back home or back to work or what have you. So it's doing this in that aspect has been super amazing. Reaching out to more people, people are on time to their sessions, all of that. However, that, you know, those moments where, you know, I just feel a client may need, you know, a hug or, you know, a pat on the back or, you know, if something amazing happens and we want to, you know, cheer or whatever, it's not as intimate as it has been in the past.
From an efficiency perspective, I feel like I'm using my time much more efficiently because I'm not wasting time on traffic or or that sort of thing. On the other side, it's really tough to meet new people and build rapport and build trust and confidence with somebody when you're separated by hundreds, thousands of miles and you have a screen, and not everybody's comfortable on camera. You know, I always have the first thought, is the person sitting across from me wearing pants? And that makes me chuckle a little bit, makes me feel a little bit more at ease when I'm feeling uncomfortable. I can tell you I am
okay, wearing pants. Good to know.
It's just absolutely good to know. I know you're not, so.
No, you know, I'm in my bikini. You know, it's 7 degrees here in Texas, you know, so I decided it was bikini weather today.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, it's cold. Great. Yeah.
So, you know, Zoom got brought up, you know, just randomly, and it's an amazing, you know, portal to be able to use. You know, so much more can be done. However, it has been... or I talk about it a lot in sessions with clients, Zoom fatigue, too many Zoom meetings. It used to be a quick, you know, even in an office, people would send just a quick little Slack message or Google chat. And now it's like, okay, time for a Zoom meeting, when it could be something as simple as a text message or a quick email. Are we taking it, or are companies, organizations taking advantage of it?
Yeah, Zoom fatigue, in my opinion, is the new word for meeting fatigue. People would spend 8 to 10 hours hopping from meeting to meeting. Mm-hmm. And in between, they try to shoot off, or even maybe in the meeting, they shoot off 10 or 20 email. And everybody feels overwhelmed with how many meetings they have, how many email they're getting. I think there's a real strategy to that from a business perspective, and it's helped me immensely, is I don't send email. I will pick up the phone. I'll schedule time during my day where people can't have meetings with me unless it's an absolute emergency. And I won't shoot an email. I'll pick up the phone. I'll try to recreate that informal environment and just blindly call somebody and just say, hey, let's chat, or shoot them a quick instant message through whatever the preferred instant message app is, and say, hey, can we have a quick 3-minute chat and just strategize about X, Y, and Z, or talk about X? And, you know, take the time while you're doing that to see how they're doing while you've got them live on the phone. You doing okay? Anything I can help you with? Boy, it's been a crazy weather in Dallas today. hope you don't slip and fall on the ice. Just be really careful.
I'll do my best. Yeah, I'll work on that.
But really trying to create that informal environment, and don't schedule meetings all day. Why do a 60-minute meeting when a 30-minute meeting is fine? I won't schedule anything longer than a 30-minute meeting for work. Okay. If you can't get it done in 30 minutes and you can't get to a decision on what needs to be done and people can't work on what they need, then your meeting's not effective.
Okay.
So I think that holds true in the COVID, our current COVID environment, and just generally in the world in general.
Okay. So with someone that, you know, you've been in and out of meetings, you know, for a good majority of your career, when you say, you know, meeting fatigue and now Zoom fatigue, how does that feel? What does that feel like for you?
In the before times, you would dial into a meeting, and if you weren't face to face, you were very comfortable with not having people on Zoom. I think, one, giving people permission to not have to be on camera, as long as people are engaged in the meeting. When I am absolutely exhausted from meetings, I know I look tired, and then that becomes a preoccupation in the back of my mind. How am I being perceived? What's my body language while I'm on camera? Do I have to kind of stay on point? If I reach over to write notes or something like that, is somebody going to think I am completely disconnected from the conversation? I want to be engaged, but I also get invited to meetings that there's really no need for me to be there, but I don't I'm not necessarily in the position to raise my hand, or the cultural atmosphere of the organization isn't one where I can say, hey, you know what, this meeting is probably not going to benefit me, or I'm not on the agenda. I need to step away. This probably isn't an effective use of my time. I don't necessarily feel always empowered to do that and decline a meeting, depending on who's asking. So yeah, there's a lot that makes me feel chained to sitting in front of the camera when I don't necessarily maybe need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would, you know, absolutely agree with that. I like the word that you use, that you feel chained, you know, almost stuck, obligated to be there, even, you know, even if, like you said, you know, it's not really a meeting that you need to be a part of. And, you know, curious as to what you do to kind of help get through that fatigue or through that feeling of being chained up.
I really try to be deliberate about when I'm going to be on camera. I also give myself permission to say, I'm not going to be on camera on this meeting. I'll respond with an accept and say, I won't be on video. I'll only be on phone for this call. Or if I see the agenda and I don't see, or if I don't get an agenda, I'll ask for an agenda beforehand and ask very clearly, what value are you expecting me to add to this meeting so that I can be prepared? And if they say, oh, it's just informational, I'll just say, send me the notes after. Taking some agency around what value I might be able to bring to that meeting. Because if I'm just going to sit there just to listen and I'm not going to have a perspective to bring, if it's really important for me to listen and to hear the decision-making process, I'm happy to do that. But if it's just a tangential conversation about something that I might not really be engaged with, I give myself permission to say no, or I'll reach out to the meeting organizer or the most powerful person in the meeting and say, hey, do you really need me there? I want to make sure that we're using all of our times most efficiently. I could be doing X, Y, or Z instead. Where would you prefer me to spend my energy? And if they say, hey, we really need you there, love your perspective, you bring a unique point of view, you might hear something, I'll say, sure, no problem. But I take the agency and then explore where my insight might be best valued. Right, and if I'm calling a meeting, I try to do the same thing. I really try to think about who really needs to be there. Right. I try to be prepared, have an agenda, make sure that people who are in the meeting know what needs to be there. And then after the meeting, providing really good materials so that folks who didn't attend the meeting would know what happened. If they, you know, if they need to know and they couldn't sit in the meeting, here's what we talked about. Here's how we got to this answer. And here what we got. And it sounds like more work, but it actually frees up a lot of time in my day so that I don't have to sit in, you know, if I can cut 3 hour-long meetings out of my schedule, I can get up and go on a short walk and think about something or prepare for something else or spend my time on something that just needs to get done without feeling guilty about not being in front of the computer.
Right. And I like the use of agency. And I think that, you know, one of the, because before, you know, before times pre-COVID, you know, people could, you know, quickly just walk into a meeting. They'd be in the meeting. They could, like you said, send out an email, what have you. And now it's when we're, you know, when we're on these Zooms, it's now we have to create the atmosphere that we're paying attention or create the atmosphere that, you know, that we are present in the meeting. And, you know, I'm curious as to how that is, you know, what anxiety is that starting to create for people? You know, I've got to look like I'm here. I got to pay attention, but I've got these, you know, 80 emails coming through, or I have to, you know, make this phone call to the, you know, to the client or what have you. And I, you know, it's been presented to me that anxiety, even if people are really doing well working from home, a sense of anxiety is starting to kind of blanket a lot of things.
If you're in a meeting for an hour and you're worried about how your time is being spent, then you're not really focused in on that meeting. I imagine that there's probably 10 minutes of focus time collectively an organization or a team will have during a meeting that's actually focused on the real problem and having substantive conversation. If you can build an environment where that focus can happen in 15-minute meetings and you can let everyone come on and say, this is your focus for the next 15 minutes. I need you 15 minutes before the meeting to prepare your thoughts for this meeting. And now we're going to be in the room for 15 minutes and have the conversation. And our goal during this meeting is to focus in on, one, what is the decision that needs to be made? Mm-hmm. Two, do we have agreement on, do we have enough information to make a decision? And three, do we have an agreement on where to go next? Then that's a successful meeting. That's what most people are trying to get out of it. If you don't have a decision or a direction, what are the next steps that you need to follow to be able to walk out of that meeting and then have a decision in the one after that, in the next meeting on the topic?
I like that.
And that'll reduce anxiety. I mean, at the end of the day, anxiety from everything that needs to get done, the disruption is where I hear a lot of angst, like, how am I going to get all of this done? Yes, I've saved a lot of time in my commute, but I've also got kids homeschooling, or I've got to check in on my parents, you know, a couple times a day because they're alone on their own where they hadn't been before. Right. There is a lot of anxiety that comes up from these conversations.
Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the anxiety that is coming up, it's not just about the work itself. It's all the changes that we've had to make, you know, as you said, you know, with the kids working from our doing school from home, you know, having to check on parents, you know, now, you know, people are like, oh, I could walk my dog more, or, you know, or laundry, anything like that. The change that's come around isn't just from the, you know, the sense of all the changes at work. There's a general sense of anxiety, you know, especially with, you know, I mean, with all the layoffs that were happening, people were, you know, getting anxious. Am I next? Am I next? No one felt empowered, or no one felt secure.
Absolutely. Your organization also doesn't have the capacity for infinite change. And change fatigue is a real thing. People are tapped out with the uncertainty, with the amount of change that they have to deal with on, you know, how to set up the work environment. Mm-hmm. If you are in the office, if you're setting up a manufacturing line to make sure that your employees are safe while they're in the plant, or being able to effectively manage folks remotely without being an overbearing leader that requires them to sit on a camera for the entire day and is patient with people who might have kids in the background or has to step away to pick up their kid from school because there's an adjusted school schedule. All of these things are real things that are outside of their control and just chips away at people's capacity to manage that change and feel comfortable in their own skin. And when we start to return to some level of normalcy, normalcy is not normal. Normal is another process of change. People are going to have to adapt to that just as much as they adapted to leaving the office as they are coming back to the office, if that's in their future. You can't force them to catch up on all the other things that had to be delayed because life got in the way. COVID got in the way. You're going to have to be very strategic and prioritize. And we talk about that in a lot more detail in part one. Mm-hmm. But that fatigue, that change fatigue, creates a level of stress on folks. Even your most resilient, most adaptable people have their change capacity chipped away and probably can't process as much as they could before. You as a leader or as an executive in an organization who might think, well, I have capacity. You don't either. You can be optimistic and you can try to set a positive tone. Mm-hmm. But the reality is the best leadership is prioritization. It's not getting everything done that initially needed to be done. It's understanding their capacity for change and prioritizing those things that are going to be most impactful to move the organization and the team forward.
Right. And, you know, something that has to be considered when we're making these changes or when leaders are making these changes as well as implementing the changes, is taking into consideration how, you know, people's, you know, mental capacity, mental health is now more prominent. Mm-hmm. It's always been there. I mean, people bring, you know, they go to work, so all their stuff is always with them. But it's taking, I think it would be important for organizations, leaders, managers, what have you, to allow space for that change. You know, more, as we spoke about in part one, more communication, more transparency. Looking for the signs that maybe someone is struggling, instead of, you know, coming, you know, calling someone up, or if they're in the office, going into the office and being like, your productivity's down, da 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 da. You know, it'd be beneficial to go, hey, what's going on?
Yeah. Regarding getting back to normal and trying to minimize that fatigue, there's something called the Lewin change model, which is a model of you try to create a stable environment, you unfreeze your stable environment, you implement a change, and then you refreeze and try to give people the opportunity to deliver and adjust to that level of normalcy. I think if you want to reduce that anxiety and reduce that change fatigue and the frustration that comes from that, having a simple plan and being thoughtful about how you're going to implement change and let people adapt is really important. But then I also hear people talking about PTSD. So I'm doing air quotes here. People talk about PTSD because of the change. Now, it's really, really important, as a non-clinician myself, although I'm a business psychologist, I'm not a clinical psychologist like you, Dr. K. I have to be really careful on how we characterize that. Now, I am educated enough to know that there is a precursor when people feel bombarded and overwhelmed and through very stressful environments. And our healthcare workers are certainly going to be at the front line of that, and as anybody could be. I don't like to call it acute stress disorder. I like to call it an acute stress response, because that's not a clinical diagnosis. It's a set of things that I'm on the lookout for all the time. And maybe Dr. Mm-hmm. K, you could talk a little bit about how you've been hearing the word PTSD used from a clinical perspective, what non-clinical folks should be careful about, and what people should be on the lookout for in their environment.
I haven't, to be honest, I haven't heard a lot of use of the, you know, the PTSD as of right now in a work environment. If people are talking PTSD, it would be, you know, stuff from earlier in their life, whether childhood or, you know, early 20, whatever, anytime prior. Now, I have had, you know, it's been talked about, what's this going to be like after? I'm scared after. And, you know, going back to work, or, you know, a year down the road when all this is still happening, there is possible that depending on, you know, the level of stress or the level of effect that COVID had on someone, whether it's that they got locked in, you know, they had to do their quarantine all by themselves, and that was overwhelming. Or, you know, unfortunately, they might have lost a family member or a friend due to COVID. You know, there is definitely possible trauma that will come from this, unfortunately. In regards to what people would look for, it would be important for people's, you know, judgment to take a, you know, and we all have judgments. We all have it. You know, it's just a part of, you know, being a human being. However, if you see someone and you're like, oh, they're being lazy, you know, or they're not doing enough work, or they're always late, or whatever the situation is, it's going, you know, you want to take that judgment out and kind of turn it around. Okay, well, maybe that, what is that person going through? You know, how are they dealing with all of this? You know, especially if it's a coworker that you've worked with for a long time. If all of a sudden they used to be a hard worker and their productivity's down, or if this worker was always 5 minutes early, you know, never was late, always early, and now all of a sudden is starting to either come in right on time, which to some, you know, to some people that's already late, but either they're, you know, coming in on time or they're starting to come in late. It's looking for those signs, changes in behaviors. You know, I'm very extroverted. So if I'm sitting at my desk and I'm not really saying hi to anyone, or, you know, if I'm, you know, chit chatting on a Zoom meeting all the time, and then that changes, it's reaching out to that person. You know, it's not assuming that there is something major going on. It could be something small. Then again, it could be something big. And if you are uncomfortable reaching out, or if it's, you know, maybe someone that you don't typically talk to or get along with, and you're noticing these changes in their behavior, I mean, it could be just as simple as coming in a little bit more disheveled. It's looking for those and then talking to the appropriate person. So if you're uncomfortable with it, maybe it's going to your manager or your HR department or, you know, any leader and saying, hey, I've noticed this in Steve or in Stacy, you know, anybody with an S, you know, it's looking at that and going, hey, I've noticed this. I'm uncomfortable talking to them. You know, maybe you could reach out.
Yeah, I think having that environment, that atmosphere within your organization that allows you to have those kind of conversations and have a safe path, and ensure that your leaders and your HR department are set up and able to process when an employee comes forward with a level of concern. Mm-hmm. It's different than it was in the before times, because, and maybe it shouldn't have been, but psychological safety is important in an organization, and having, you don't want to feel like you're ratting out your neighbor if they're having a bad day, but right. Your neighbor doesn't want to feel like somebody's going to run to HR when maybe they just had a bad day. Mm-hmm. And you've got to have that environment structured, and your culture and your atmosphere within your organization able to deal with that and create an environment where having those conversations mm-hmm. is okay. And I think another area where these kind of stresses really, really tick up is there are a lot more interpersonal conflicts that are likely to happen. Mm-hmm. People in those conversations may become more frustrated with one another. If I'm overwhelmed and I'm feeling exceptionally stressed out, my capacity for dealing with somebody who might be a little thick in getting my point, or might not be meeting my expectation in some way or another, I might lose my patience a lot faster. I could step on a landmine, lose my patience or lose my temper with somebody, and that could end up in HR from that person through something that would have traditionally been viewed as a disciplinary concern. Mm-hmm. There has to be a lot more step back, evaluate, try to figure out where that person is psychologically and emotionally. And again, I don't expect a manager to be able to evaluate symptoms of this, but they should be looking for warning signs and then mm-hmm. engage somebody who is better qualified mm-hmm. to deal with the psychological and emotional challenges that these organizations are facing today.
Absolutely agreed. It's, you know, it's definitely not the place of a leader to diagnose or to maybe give advice to some extent, you know, especially if there is something major going on. However, reaching out sometimes can be just enough for someone, you know, to be able to verbalize what's going on for them might be enough for them to feel, okay, I'm supported. You know, I know someone's there if I need it. I can get through this. I can get through the day. It's, you know, something that organizations may need to consider. Maybe bringing you know, a professional in, whether it's a therapist or whether it's, you know, they have group, I mean, there's more meetings, but, you know, maybe a group facilitator that can, you know, talk about, you know, the different emotions and feelings and reactions that may come about when we go back into work or even through Zoom. I mean, we got the Zoom. You can do a whole bunch of people on those. You know, it's doing, you know, little group meetings. And also, you know, when we were discussing making changes, that might have to be one of the changes that gets put into place that might not have been thought about, you know, pre-COVID or before times, but now it is something that needs to be thought about.
Yeah, organizations have to have an atmosphere where you can talk about these things without judgment. Mm-hmm. The leadership and your human capital channels have to be able to support and deal with these things objectively and without mm-hmm. judgment. Leaders have to recognize the warning signs. And then there is working through all of those individual issues that come up during the day that a leader might not be equipped to deal with. If you have two employees that are not gelling, don't try to solve that yourself. Making them go out and have lunch together might not solve the problem, but getting, you know, having an on-staff coach or somebody who can help facilitate a conversation, mm-hmm. having those resources available. So it comes down to structure, it comes down to insight, it comes down to atmosphere, and it comes down to mm-hmm. availability of the right resources. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's also important that leaders, you know, no matter what level they're at, is recognizing their own anxiety that they may have, or depression, or whatever's going on for them. You know, this isn't just about, you know, anyone below a leader. This is everyone across the board. You know, even the founder of a company, you know, a lot has changed in the last year. You know, so again, some good, some bad, but a lot has changed. And, you know, it's bringing in that emotional intelligence and recognizing, wait, I used to never do this, and now I do this. Or, you know, I added this aspect in, and this isn't how I used to be. And then it's trying to get whatever, you know, whatever help you may need. It might be just from a coach, you know, hey, I used to be able to stand in front of, you know, all of my team and do my spiel. And now I'm uncomfortable. Now I start sweating. Now I'm anxious. I get nauseous before, you know, that doesn't mean that you've lost your ability to be a great leader. You just might've gained some anxiety because you've been sitting in front of a camera for a year.
Or you've had to make tough choices and lay off some of your team, mm-hmm. and it's really difficult to face your organization.
Yeah.
You know, these are difficult times, and executive leaders and organizations certainly aren't immune, as you say, Dr. K. We recognize that leaders have a disproportionate amount of burden of the success of the organization. The marketplace has changed dramatically, mm-hmm. and the C-suite has to adapt. There are all of these myriad of issues that are facing the employees. The executive team is accountable to resolving those issues. Mm-hmm. And all of the changes and all of the usual stressors of the day affect leaders in just the same way. Now, some leaders might be more than able to adapt and deal with those, but I guarantee you, everyone knows an executive who is probably harder around the edges and maybe lacks a little bit of empathy, is a significant driver who mm-hmm. says, I don't care about all of this emotional nonsense. I'm going to drive the team, and they just need to figure it out and deal with it.
Right.
Those leaders are danger. They could be exceptionally harmful to an organization. Mm-hmm. And it is critically important that they're not allowed to run roughshod over the operations, because they could create serious and lasting damage in an organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's going to be it's a lot of changes need to be made within not just the organization itself, but within the people. You know, there's, you know, we, you know, I believe that having, you know, those tough managers are beneficial to organizations to an extent. Mm-hmm. You know, we need someone that's like, OK, drive a little harder. Let's go. We need this. These are the numbers. I know it sounds like we're not going to make it, but, you know, we're going to make it, and this is what we'll do. However, I absolutely agree that they could, without any regards to what is going on for their employees, could have lasting damage, whether it's lasting damage to the employee itself or lasting damage to the organization.
An effective leader is someone who leverages their strengths to their best, minimizes mm-hmm. their weaknesses, and is adaptable to recognize when they need to be stronger or they need to step back and let others lead. I'm not sure that in times of stress, people tend to lean in more towards their strengths and may even overdo their strengths. And it's really important to have a sounding board for executive leaders to get some extra support, whether that is working through your organizational development team within your organization so that folks have resources available, or bringing in an executive coach or allowing them to rely on their executive coach. And then, of course, there is the mental health aspect. People may just need extra support from a therapist during this time. And we have to remove this stigma from business that executives should have access and be comfortable with saying, hey, I need a little bit of an extra emotional support during this time. I need to make sure that my mind is clear and I'm thinking about things in the right way. An executive coach is great for getting that clarity around thinking, but that emotional support and that psychological support, reaching out to a therapist is probably beneficial as well. And setting the expectation from the board or from the C-suite that we have resources available, and if we see warning signs, we strongly suggest that you follow a path, is good for the leader, good for the employee. And it's also mitigates a lot of risk, because if somebody has an event where the senior leader loses their cool for 15 minutes in a meeting, that could expose legal risk. They could say something that would be completely inappropriate. Right. Or in many states across the US, there are anti-bullying laws, and people who are succumbing to a high level of stress and have specific personality characteristics might overdo some of their thoughts or some of their what they're thinking to their team and put the organization at risk.
Right now, it is shaky ground on how to move forward, shaky ground on what are the most appropriate steps, shaky ground on how to even identify what is going to be necessary. But that's kind of what we are trying to do, you know, in this podcast, is to bring forth this here. These are the things that we are recognizing through research or just through talking, what have you. And it's bringing forth like these are issues that may not have to be an issue if you start taking steps towards them, if you start preparing for them.
Absolutely. Nobody's perfect, but the environment can be set up to support imperfection.
Absolutely.
Given the conversation we've had, Dr. K, how can leaders prepare?
Seeing what is coming from COVID, from quarantine, from jobs loss, and looking at that going, okay, that's a problem. What are steps that I can take for that? I believe that leaders would benefit from maybe taking workshops. There's workshops available out there. You know, there's ones that they could do quickly online, workshops that talk about emotional intelligence, that talk about, you know, what anxiety might look like, anxiety or depression or what have you in the workplace. They also, you know, beneficial to bring in, you know, a coach of some sort so that they can sit and strategize what we need to do. But it needs to start now. Not, okay, we're going to be back in the office in June and then we'll start talking about it. You could always talk to your employees. What are you going through? What are you scared of? What's been working for you? You know, if they're your employees, if they continue to be your employee, they're doing something right. So talk to them.
Yeah.
You know, you can send out a survey, or you can say, hey, I am open. Send me your questions or send me your concerns, and then we'll set up a time to talk.
Yeah. And I would add that it's important to recognize each person's experience through the COVID journey. It's not unique, and everyone has the tools to deal with the loss of loved ones, the prolonged social isolation. There is change clearly ahead as we head back to a new normal. Change, fear, uncertainty, anxiety, they're all present. Give time for stabilization and a sense of normalcy to root. watch for change fatigue, understand acute stress response symptoms, recognize the warning signs, and have a path to resolve behavioral and mental health issues safely and without judgment, and have a clear plan to increase psychological safety in the organization, and make sure your executives, leaders, human resources, infrastructure are adequately supported. Bring in some experts where your organization may not be able to support.
Absolutely agreed. It's, you know, it's taken that the resources are out there. Use them. Don't be scared of them. It's not going to make the organization look bad if you're bringing in expert help.
Right.
Especially if you're doing it for your employees. People are going to want to work for you. They're going to be proud to work for you. They're going to tell their friends and their family, you know, this is what they did to make us feel safe.
Excellent.
I'm excited about next week's topic as well.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited about next week's topic. We're going to explore the idea of organizational atmosphere in the workplace and how it's distinct from organizational culture. But it's entirely necessary to ensure the organizational culture is consistently idealized across the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a great topic because the culture or the atmosphere, I mean, they can be two different things. How do you make them good together? And how do you make them go well with the employees? Because the employees have everyone's different. So how does it? So I'm excited for this topic. I love, you know, talking about atmosphere and creating safe spaces. And, you know, that is kind of what I do anyway. So that's super exciting for me. And to everyone out there listening, I'm super excited to have you join us on this journey in the realm. And thank you so much. I'm Dr. K.
And I'm Dr. D, and we are looking forward to your next visit to the executive realm.